Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Connolly, Judge Gaetis, Judge Larson, the Honorable Francis J. Connolly presiding.
Thank you. Let's all be seated. Good morning. Our first case this morning is Hook and Ladder Apartments, respondent versus, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Nicole Nalawaja. It's court file 823-1048. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, just approach the podium, adjust the height of the podium and the microphone to your level, and just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gary Van Winkle. I will be presenting the appellant's argument before the court this morning. I'm joined at counsel table by attorney Courtney Arthur, and there are members of our appellant team in the audience as well this morning. Thank you.
So I assume we can assume Ms. Arthur did all the work.
Yeah. There are so many others who did the work, Your Honor. But I'm happy to be here this morning, and I'm happy to have this opportunity. I want to start off by letting the court know that this case is about a debt collection practice, and it's particularly about an eviction that resulted from a debt collection practice that is prohibited under Minnesota law and Minnesota public policy. Specifically, that debt collection practice is landlord or a landlord's associate shutting off a tenant's electricity in order to collect a debt. This practice is clearly prohibited by Minnesota Statute Section 504B.221. But I want to get to the major assignments of error in this case, which are first, the finding that when, on the night of October 3rd, 2022, into the morning of the 4th, right around midnight, Ms. Nalawaya and an acquaintance went to the end of the hall where there's a locked utility closet and forced the door open after her electricity had been shut off earlier in the day. Ms. Nalawaya is a disabled, heavily subsidized tenant who lives in an apartment under terms of which her monthly rent is $22. It's heavily subsidized. She has disabilities, anxiety-related disabilities. She has 3 minor children, and was notified by her children the afternoon of October 3rd, 2022, that their electricity had been shut off. And it was about midnight of that night that Ms. Nalawaya and an acquaintance went to the end of the hall where there are submeters located, submeters that are installed and owned by the landlord. And Ms. Nalawaya and her acquaintance, specifically her acquaintance, forced open the locked utility closet door and restored the electricity. This resulted in the eviction that brings us here today. And it's important to understand that there wasn't even any evidence in the record that the lock had to be replaced or that there was any significant property damage. And so it is important to understand in the good cause analysis that basically 2 things happened here. A locked closet door was forced open and electricity was restored. And as we—
Could a landlord, I think in the brief you said jimmied the lock. Could a landlord do that to go into a tenant's apartment?
No, not unless there were an emergency or other contingency that required immediate entry. Ordinarily, in order for the landlord to enter the apartment, there'd have to be 24 hours notice to the tenant that that was going to happen.
Landlords can't use self-help. I mean, that's the general rule to evict someone.
That's correct. That's, of course, as the court, I'm sure, is well aware, the Berg versus Wiley holding. And so what happened in this case was electricity was restored. There is some implication in the record, and also it was part of the trial court's finding that that good cause, the good cause finding is supported by the possibility that her acquaintance inadvertently shut off the power of other tenants. We would submit that this doesn't meet the good cause standard in federal law, which contemplates repeated acts of serious disruption. And this is an isolated.
Clear. Are you saying that the power was turned off for other tenants, or even if it wasn't serious?
We don't believe it was turned off by other tenants. We disagree.
Does the record support the district court's finding on that point?
Well, the district court's finding is, and I can read that very quickly to the court exactly from
ahead, Mr. Van Winkle.
From addendum, our addendum in our initial brief, page A8. This is the finding, and it is reasonable to infer that someone unfamiliar with such a breaker could potentially turn off the power of other residents in the course of their action. That's the strength of the court's conclusion from the record that there might have been inadvertent disruption of other
Did
tenants'
power. Did the caretaker
power.
Testify that power to other units were turned off at that time?
The caretaker testified that there was flipping of the switches that the caretaker noticed, but it wasn't clear from the caretaker's testimony that this was necessarily attributable to Ms. Nalawaya's acquaintance. The fact is that the landlord, after the landlord shut off my client's power on the 3rd, then when the power was restored at midnight of the 4th, the 3rd into the 4th, the landlord revisited the property during business hours of the 4th, and the testimony from the caretaker was that 22 units were actually shut off the morning of the 4th. So there's really nothing in the record to suggest that somebody's power was restored on the 4th. And so we would submit that even given the strongest possible construction of the court's finding and conclusion, it still only establishes perhaps an accidental and temporary turnoff that was presumably restored the next day, if there were such a thing. So that's the point, is that the federal statutes in this kind of a subsidized tenancy contemplate serious, repeated, and particularly egregious in terms of property damage or in terms of demonstrable and significant disruption to the community. And that evidence isn't present in this case. And so we would submit that finding and that conclusion is not supported by the record as a matter.
It seems to me, counsel, that your claim as to that issue is sort of inextricably intertwined with the argument that you first made, which is that this was an illegal billing practice. In other words, it's very difficult to take your good cause claim out of the context of what happened, which is that this was an attempt to restore power that you're asserting was unlawfully turned off. I'm wondering if we removed that context and just assumed, for example, that the acquaintance entered another type of area that was strictly off limits to the tenants of the building. Say, an area that allowed direct access to the sewer system. Would your good cause argument be the same? Would it be as strong as you're asserting?
Thank you for that question, Judge Gaitis. Actually, it is a case-by-case basis, and I do think this would be a different case if we had more demonstrable damage to the property or more demonstrable actions inimical to the landlord's interest other than restoring the power and upsetting this debt collection practice. In this case, with regard to the context, again, I think it's important to remember we're talking about a tenant with three minor children whose monthly rental is $22 a month. There's testimony in the record that when her electricity was shut off, she lost $200 worth of food in the refrigerator. And she's got three minor children. And so that is the context. The landlord has basically self-helped itself to essentially a constructive eviction. It's basically unilaterally rendered the tenancy uninhabitable in an effort to collect on a debt. And so Ms. Nalawaya, the night of the 3rd into the morning of the 4th, was in the position of responding to an emergency that threatened her family. And so that is the context for which the restoration of power occurred. And that's really what this eviction is about. And that's my other point to the court. This eviction is not about damage or disruption. This eviction is really about, we don't want you challenging our debt collection practice. Now, Ms. Nalawaya did on the 4th, or on the 5th, I'm sorry, on the 5th, provide notice that she was going to seek relief in housing court through an emergency tenant remedies action. That was the same day that she received her lease termination notice. So that's the dynamic at work in this case, which is don't disrupt this debt collection practice. And if you do, we're going to evict you. And so that's where I think it's important to understand the other part of the court's finding that we hold is a direct error. And that is in our addendum on page A8. At the very, very bottom, paragraph number 20, the disconnect was not unlawful. We completely disagree with that. That's a direct error of law. The disconnection is unlawful. What is before the court and what is before the trial court previously was, do the actions in this context of Ms. Nalawaya's acquaintance with Ms. Nalawaya's acquiescence constitute good cause sufficient to evict her and her children? And our answer to that question is no, it does not. It doesn't meet the good cause standard, and it also is a clear violation of Minnesota law and policy. And the statute, 504B.221, makes very clear at the very beginning, if a landlord, an agent, or other person acting under the landlord's direction or control interrupts or causes the interruption of electricity, et cetera, the tenant may recover from the landlord treble damages or $500. That's not qualified. It's a straight statement of the law. And the title for that section is 504B221, Unlawful Termination of Utilities.
I'm just wondering if you could address how a court could get there in an eviction action. In other words, clearly, the statute provides for a cause of action that a tenant can bring for damages in the event of an illegal shutoff, but it's a little more challenging for me to understand how the statute itself provides a defense to an eviction action in light of the Keller case, for example. And just given the plain language of the statute itself, which contemplates an action for damages. So maybe you could help me with that.
Thank you for that question, Judge Gaetis. The housing court, of course, is a court of equity. And the landlord, the fact in this case is none of this would have happened but for the landlord's illegal shutoff. So it's not only a prerequisite to the actions that resulted in the eviction claim, it's also factually inseparable from, in other words, the eviction itself is as a matter of logic, is a direct result of the shutoff. If the shutoff hadn't occurred, the eviction would not have occurred. And so the landlord comes to this action, the eviction action that the landlord filed, with unclean hands. And if this court finds that the trial court ruled correctly, then what is happening is that the landlord's debt collection practice, which clearly violates 221, will have been affirmed, which will basically send a message to landlords who are increasingly sub-metering multi-dwelling buildings in the metro area that this is okay. It's okay
to... But why wasn't the appropriate procedure to bring a separate action under 504B221, as opposed to bringing a counterclaim in the eviction action?
Well, thank you for that question, Judge Larson. We were faced with an eviction, obviously, and Ms. Nalawaya, as I mentioned previously, had already started the ETRA process when she got the notice of lease termination. But we had to respond to the eviction action itself. The eviction action itself included 6 breach counts.
But then, I mean, procedurally, why isn't this a separate action under 504B.221 and then a retaliation defense that there was a violation of 504B.221 in the eviction action as opposed to bringing a counterclaim?
Well, because it is a defense in equity, I would submit. I see my time is up.
Please answer her question, Mr. Van Winkle.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge Connolly.
You're welcome.
It is a defense to the eviction, and 504B.221, unlike 504B.161 or repair actions, which do require a separate action, 504B.221 on its face is self-executing. It doesn't require that it be brought as part of a repair action or as a separate action. It's a self-executing statute that provides a penalty for illegal utility shutoffs, so that the statute itself doesn't narrow its applicability. It can be brought as a counterclaim or as an affirmative defense, or it could be raised in an ETRA or rent escrow action, but it doesn't limit. And in this case, procedurally, we were faced with an unjust eviction. And so we raised it as a counterclaim, which also could be considered an affirmative defense, but we would submit that still provides the protection of the statute, because the statute is intended to prevent illegal shutoffs, which is what caused this eviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Van Winkle. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Eric Hansen, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Hook and Ladder Apartment, LLP. This case is an example of the appellant trying to transform it into something that it is not. This is an
appeal. Well, he seems to be doing a very good job of it.
I would use vigorous as my analogy, but definitely. So we're here talking about a number of issues. I think it is important that the court start with what's on appeal. And what's on appeal is a decision by district court, trial court, referee of eviction, and that is reviewed basically for plain error, right? The decisions made, the factual determinations made by the district court have to be, it's basically, is there any support in the record at all for the conclusions of the district court? And ultimately...
Well, I would push back a little bit on that. Isn't our standard of review a little more rigorous than that?
On questions of law,
I guess I'm a little confused about what our standard of review even is in this case. It seems like the two sides are arguing that it should be, completely different things. And I guess I'd first like to figure out what we are reviewing for on the question, on the first question in the case, whether there was a good cause for the eviction. Is that a mixed question? Is that that we review de novo? Are we reviewing that simply for clear error? What's your position on that? And that's something, of course, that your opposing counsel will have a chance to address and rebuttal.
Sure. And I would say that as to factual determinations, that's clear error. So the question then is there any evidence in the record at all to support? I believe that with regard to the questions of law, the court and I'll cite to the case I cited in my opening statement. Appellant courts correct erroneous applications of law, but defer to the district court's ultimate conclusions, which are reviewed for abuse of discretion. And that's from the Porch v. General Motors Acceptance Corporation case, 2002 from this.
Which is not a housing case.
It is not. And I would say there's a number of precedents on this. I think we've cited the ones that we think are appropriate. I think that if there is an error of law, I think it is proper that this court views that as well within its authority to correct. If there is a factual determination, then I think the court has to ask, is there any support of the record for that factual conclusion? So have I seen a case that says that this is a mixed question of fact and law? I don't recall one. I probably would have cited it to you if I'd had seen it. But I think that it is clear from my review of the cases that talk about the standard of review that it is designed to be a more deferential standard. And there is a reason for it. And that reason is that evictions are designed to be summary proceedings with limited scopes, with the idea that we intend as a society to move these matters through relatively quickly. Ultimately, that was done with the idea that we didn't want these things to drag out for multiple years because it defeats the purpose and it then results in engaging in self-help. That's the public policy behind that. We cited some of that in our brief. I think that that is true for this matter.
Do you agree that appellant raised a retaliation defense in this case?
Do I agree that they properly raised a retaliation defense? No. Do I believe that the district court addressed their retaliation defense? Yes.
They cite to their answer in terms of that they raised a retaliation defense, and I guess I would just, where would you point me to in the district court's order that they actually decided the retaliation issue? Because I do think that under Olson, it's pretty clear that is now a common law claim that should be decided in these eviction actions.
I don't believe that it's in the final order. I believe that was decided in the preceding orders when they're on the motions to dismiss. I apologize, I don't have that right in front of me, but I believe that's where that occurred.
Does that go to the whole, is it a counterclaim, is it an affirmative defense issue?
It does.
Okay. And from your remembrance of the record, and I understand you don't have that decision, did they raise retaliation as an affirmative defense, i.e. defenses won retaliation?
I don't recall it being pled that way, no.
So what's your position, Mr. Hansen, on, I guess I'm a little unclear from the record as to how appellant's friend got into this room where the meters are. So what does the record indicate as to how that happened? I mean, it sounds like the lock wasn't broken, you tell me.
I will. Basically, what we've got is a videotape showing.
What does the videotape show?
It shows Ms. Nalawaja acting as a lookout and him over with what appears to be a screwdriver working on the door. And
is
I think that's
like a code door thing?
No. Okay. It's a relatively, and I believe there's testimony in Mr. Tomlinson's testimony in the transcript. It's specific. Property manager guy, correct. It's basically a push-button kind of lock that you could lock it from the inside by pushing a button and pulling the door shut, and that otherwise there would be a key to open it. And he then talks about, he uses the word jimmied the lock, and he talks about looking at it and having it been pried. And I think that's entirely consistent with what you can see from the videotape.
And I would. So this is not a thing like where you kind of use a credit card and you can kind of get through the, and you know, then it just magically opens.
No, okay. Nope. This was pride, and I think there's some testimony in Mr. Tomlinson's testimony where he talks about it doesn't look initially like the lock's broken, but when you get up to it and look carefully, you can see marks where it was jimmied, and that's his testimony.
But you don't disagree with appellants that the lock wasn't, that there's no testimony that the lock was actually broken?
I don't think that's just not in the record. There is not, there was not, if the court's question is, did Hook and Ladder go in and say, and you owe us $12 because we replaced the lock? No, that's not there. The question is simply, was it secured? The answer was yes. Did they break into it? Yes. Were they unauthorized to do so? Yes. Did after they break in, did they mess with everybody else's power in the rest of the building? Yes.
Well, I do think that the question comes down to looking at the terms of the lease and, you know, whether, I think the amount of damage does come down to some of the terms of the lease as opposed to, right, because some of these terms of the lease have to do with damage that the district court found. Some of them have to do with disrupting other people. Some of them have to do with illegal activity. So in terms of what provisions of the lease you're alleging are violated, it does seem like those facts are relevant.
Respectfully, I don't know that I'd agree. Because of the subsidized nature of this, there's a good faith standard that's imposed that, they've cited some where that's part of the argument as well. If it's minor damage and they analogize to a New York decision where there's crayon on the walls, they say, well, that's not really damage and therefore not a violation of the lease. I think the question that is before this court is, did the district court err in concluding that there was a material breach of the lease by the process of breaking and entering? And
which whether requires them to violate one of the provisions of the lease.
It does.
Okay. And that's the point that I'm trying to make. The amount of whether or not there was actual damage to the door probably goes to whether some of those provisions of the lease were violated.
I think that you could break something deliberately and cause in low monetary amounts harm that would still be important and significant for a material breach of the lease.
I do have some questions with regard to this, the billing practices and the district court's decision that this was not a single meter system. Right. Because it seems to me that, you know, the law is pretty clear that you have multimeter systems because those are multimeter systems are regulated by Xcel. Xcel is bound by lots of different consumer protection statutes as well as regulations from the PUC. And then you have the statutes with regard to landlords and what they can do when there's a single meter coming from the utility. And I'm just wondering what in the way that this is set up does not make JIT an agent of the landlord under the statute when it doesn't appear to me that JIT is bound by the same regulations that Xcel Energy would if they were directly providing the power to these units.
I don't know if I entirely agree with that. There was Mr. DeBoer testified at a fair amount of length at the trial as to what they were and were not bound, what JIT believed that they were bound by. Respectfully, I think that this goes to a much broader issue, which is, do we have a developed record in an eviction setting to conclude that somehow this billing practice of having separate meters is, as they say, an illegal billing scheme, or as the district court found,
appropriate? I think it's being able to shut off the power outside of the scope of the utility regulations that Xcel would have to comply with in order to shut off the power.
So I think the testimony was from JIT that they complied with all of the regulations, including the cold weather shutoff rules.
I don't know that under the statute. I think the question is whether JIT would have to comply, not whether or not they did comply in this case.
Well,
in terms of whether this is a practice that is allowed under Minnesota law from a legal perspective.
So let me play that out then. Then let's assume for the sake of our discussion that they're correct, that this was improper. Okay, then there is a mechanism. This court has said so repeatedly. There is a way that you go and you vindicate this right, and that is to bring another action, an actual district court action. You use that district court action to enjoin the eviction action, and you resolve these issues properly and not in the expedited system of an eviction. And there's plenty of case law on this, and it goes to more than just evictions, but you see this in disputes over ownership of property, where there's an enjoinment of the eviction proceeding, and it is because there are all kinds of factual questions that, respectfully, we're all just kind of guessing on because it's just not in the record. We have one individual from JIT who comes in and says, this is what we're bound by. We have basically testimony and, frankly, argument presented as, well, this is all illegal and it's an improper billing scheme and a debt collection scheme. And there's nothing in the record that really establishes this one way or the other. And my
does
point...
that indicate, Mr. Hansen, who gets the money? I mean, for the, you know, does the landlord keep the money that goes, that's supposed to go to the utilities, or where does the money, or do, who, I mean, does JIT keep it? Do they give it to the landlord? Do they give it to XL? Do we not know?
On this record, for sure, we don't know.
Okay.
I believe JIT keeps it, but I don't know. And your question goes to this point that...
Well, I mean, my question goes to sort of following up on Judge Larson's question, kind of like the agent thing.
Right.
I mean, your argument is they're not an agent, so you can't hold your client available by dumping on JIT.
Right. And what they're trying to do is string this chain of argument. They're trying to make an equitable claim of unclean hands. And to make that claim, they're saying that JIT wrongfully acted and that you should then impute their wrongful intent onto the landlord and that is how they get to their unclean hands argument, at least as I understand it. It's not especially clear. And as I understand our equitable doctrines, the idea is we look to the intent of the parties. Here, the landlord sought eviction because these people broke in and turned off everybody else's power, turned on and off everybody else's power in
the building.
Well,
that's not the finding of the district court.
The
finding of the district court is that other people's power may have been turned off.
I think that the district court states it more directly than that, Your Honor. But ultimately, the court's more than adept at reading what the district court said or not. My characterization of it is less important.
May I ask one more
Yes,
question?
Please go ahead, Judge Larson.
I have one, too, as well, when we're done, just to give everyone a heads up. I'm hoping to ask one, too.
I'm just wondering, as we discussed, I do think that there is one procedure in terms of bringing this as a separate claim. I do wonder what the intersection is of the allegations regarding 504B.221 with the common law retaliation claim that the Supreme Court recognized in the Olson case in 2019, and whether the district court, I just am wondering what your position is on whether the district court needed to make a decision on whether there was a legal violation in order to decide the retaliation claim. In the context of, do we need to reach the issue of 504B?
I think the answer is you don't need to reach that issue. And as I understand the argument, it's this unclean hands that somehow you have to impute to the landlord that basically it's a retaliation defense with an unclean hands argument that the only reason why she's being evicted is because she complained about something. And that just doesn't match the record. She broke in before she complained to anybody about anything.
Well, and I guess that leads to my question, final question. What are we to do with this retaliation claim? I want to pin you down on your position on the retaliation claim before you sit down. In your brief, you say the district court didn't err in rejecting the claim. Today, I thought I heard you say that maybe the district court didn't address the claim. I don't see anywhere in the district court's order where the court addressed the claim. What's your position on that retaliation claim in the district court's approach?
My position is that to the extent that the district court did address it, it was addressed in the motions prior to the eviction order.
In the evidentiary?
Correct.
Motions?
Yes. And I believe that the district court did consider retaliation and concluded that it wasn't applicable. Is the record as clear as I would like on that point? It is not. Ultimately, I think that if there was a separate action, that would be litigated. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hansen. Mr. Van Winkle, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I think it's clear the construction of 504B221 that's being urged here. 504B221 is a direct ban of the procedure that occurred in this case, and what the respondent wants this court to consider to be the correct interpretation of 504B221 is that you can still shut off a tenant's power to collect a debt as long as you're the right person to do it. And that's just not a fair reading of 504B221. And it is also an end run around the eviction, self-help eviction protections in Berg versus Wiley. Because if landlords are going to shut off tenants at sub-meters throughout the Twin Cities, that's a constructive eviction every time it happens. And it basically throws Berg versus Wiley as well as 504B221 right out the window. And that's what we're really asking the court to address, is the proper application of 504B221. Now, the retaliation defense was pled in the answer, and it was raised in the written argument. There was quite a lot of motion practice with regard to the issue of waiver, which I won't get into right now. However, I do not recall a specific address by the court to the merits of the retaliation claim. So it was pled, it was argued, and from the court's order, I think this court can fairly conclude that retaliation was either not addressed or not adequately addressed. The point about retaliation, though, leads to the other aspect of this debt collection practice that is so important. The debt collection, the backside, if you will, of this debt collection practice is, if you challenge this practice, we're going to target you. And so that's also part of the practice. They don't, at first, right, the eviction happened in March of 2023. Got to keep my year straight, right? The shutoff occurred in October of 2022. The complaints and the reverberations of that shutoff practice continued from October 2022 to March of 2023 when the eviction was finally filed. There was no damage, there was no lasting problem for the landlord as a result of that one reconnection of power, and there was no threat that it was ever going to happen again. So what is the point of the eviction in March of 2023? The point is you're out. We know that you're challenging this debt collection practice, and we're not going to abide that. And so that's exactly the applicability of the retaliation defense. That is the second aspect of this debt collection model, is we're going to turn off your power if you don't pay, and if you challenge us, we're going to evict you. And the court did not adequately address the retaliation defense, and that's another assignment of error in this case.
How do you respond to the I do think that the record shows, and if I use the wrong term, you can correct me, that the next day your client received like a notice of termination, and then there's some period before the eviction action happened. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so how do we, I mean, so I think that the argument that respondent is making is that your client didn't threaten the action until after she had received that notice. Is that, and that therefore, for the purpose of a retaliation claim, her actions after she received the notice aren't relevant to a retaliation claim.
Well, thank you for that question, Judge. I would be happy to clarify my position on that. So the retaliation claim is relevant to the date of filing, March 14th of 2023.
Of the eviction action as opposed to receiving
exactly,
the notice.
Exactly. And that's and we didn't go into detail about this in our filings, but that's an error by the trial court as well, excluding significant evidence of her complaints because they came after October 5th, when in fact the target date for making the retaliation analysis is March 14th of 2023, not October 5th of 2022.
Do you have a case to support that?
I don't have a case on the top of my head, Your Honor. I'm sorry, but that's the application of the statute 291. Is the retaliation is the eviction itself, which occurred. Which, by the way, I will add something to the record now that I think if there's digging in the court record, this is apparent. But actually, there was a filing in December of 2022 that was dismissed. So there was another filing in this matter on this issue with the six breach claims, and you know, five of them were dismissed in the 2023 filing, but there was an eviction filing in 2022 that was dismissed. So there was also a period from December of 2022 to March of 2023 where there was nothing here. There was no lasting damage, there was no repetitive action, there was nothing more, but this was still an issue, and so there was a refiling in March, and that is part of the retaliation claim, is that this really does not constitute good cause, and the real motivation for this eviction is to fulfill that debt collection practice, which is to say, if you challenge us, we're going to evict you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Van Winkle. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. We will be issuing our decision within 90 days.